that have formed a substantial complement of most armies. An interesting feature of the Iraq campaign is the relatively high, by modern standards, number of mercenaries employed by the United States. Financial rewards can be less direct, too. Free college tuition is a tempting reason to join the military, as is the prospect of gainful employment. Recruitment practices can be morally problematic in a variety of ways. They might be unfairly exclusionary. For instance, the U.S. military's attitude to homosexuals is rather different from Plato's. The institution of a draft might violate autonomy, forcing individuals to fight against their will. Even volunteer armies are constituted to a disproportionately large extent by underprivileged social groups, especially when it comes to fighting, raising concerns of social justice. The poor used as cannon fodder by the wealthy, to put it polemically. Or a volunteer army might attract mostly thugs who will use membership in the military as a pretext to commit moral violations. Next, consider training of a specifically military sort, to fight and kill. How do you get people to fight at all? The prevailing strategy is to condition military personnel so that they will respond appropriately to situations and orders without having to think about them. They need to be physically fit, and the physical training is employed in a disciplinary fashion to discourage individuality and develop a team mentality. To appropriately react to situations, it's desirable to have ingrained responses to make them a part of muscle memory, so that trained individuals will just execute as desired when required. The education and combat training programs on Camino that Lama Su is so proud of seem to accomplish this very efficiently. Take the case of Anakin Skywalker. His Jedi training came relatively late. We see other Jedi being inducted into Jedi ways as small children by Yoda, away from the influence of their families and others, rather like being raised in a monastery. The clear implication is that part of Anakin's problem is that he was not sufficiently inculcated, not brainwashed enough, to cope fully with his ability to use the Force and the responsibility that goes with it. Presumably, it would have been better either that he had undergone the full training or else not have been trained at all. Typical military training can be morally problematic. The more autonomy soldiers have to begin with, the more problematic it is to employ brainwashing techniques to get them to do what we want, to fight, kill, and die for the rest of us. With humans, it doesn't seem as problematic to provide positive inducements to fight, at least for mercenaries. But inducements such as free college education are directed more towards the young who may not be properly assessing the very real risk that they will actually be called on to fight. Even where autonomy is diminished, the justification of brainwashing is usually that it is for the individual's own good, to protect them from themselves until they are better able to choose. This argument cannot be generally deployed in the case of military training. Granted, if a man is going to fight anyway, he might be better off with full military training. But other things being equal, he is surely better off not to be in the military at all. Or if he is in the military, not in a fighting capacity. That military training is morally problematic does not altogether prohibit it, but it does seem that, if it were to be justified, it would have to promise and deliver much good. When we add these considerations to the already strong presumption against warfare, it may be that very few actual campaigns have sufficient merit. Send in the clones. Clones with relatively diminished autonomy may provide the most morally satisfying solution. They are not offered inducements to fight, removing one area of concern about those with diminished autonomy. Moreover, since they will never acquire full autonomy, the argument that they need protection from themselves until they know better is undercut. There are still moral problems with an army of diminished clones. We tend to find the training and deployment of fighting dogs to be more distasteful than the training and deployment of human soldiers, in part because the dogs are relatively lacking in autonomy. So we should likewise be concerned about raising fighting men and women who really don't know any better. But given the alternatives, all in all, it may be best to send in the clones. Part 3. Don't call me a mindless philosopher. Alien technologies and the metaphysics of the Force. Chapter 9. A technological galaxy. Heidegger and the Philosophy of Technology in Star Wars. Gerald J. Abrams. In the dark age of the Empire, the light of the Force has all but gone out of the world, and the few remaining Jedi look to misty ages of an ancient past for guidance in their struggle against the forces of evil. Obi-Wan refers to the lightsaber as an elegant weapon for a more civilized age. And he describes the Jedi Knights as guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic, before the Dark Times, before the Empire. The same view of history is echoed in the writings of the 20th century German philosopher Martin Heidegger, 1889-1976. Rather than making progress, our greatest days are, in fact, behind us, and history is actually getting worse. A corruption has set in, like the fall in the Garden of Eden. Only here, in Heidegger and Star Wars, our sin is technology, or, more specifically, what Heidegger calls, enframing. This is the process of reorganizing all the various elements of nature, trees and rocks, rivers and animals, carving them up and placing them into so many artificial frames, all to be used up as resources. Ultimately, at the end of our present age, all that will remain of the earth is a synthetic ball of parts and wires, glass and steel, all uniform and very unnatural, like a Death Star residing in the cold, dark reaches of space. Indeed, this is precisely the problem of technology we find in Star Wars. True, it may at first glance appear that progress is defined by the ascent of technology, a view advanced, for example, by Han Solo. But on closer analysis, the path of technological enframing is precisely what distorts our vision of the Force. Heidegger on technology. In philosophizing about the present age, Heidegger wants to understand what exactly went wrong with our culture, how we ended up with all these atom bombs and world wars and nuclear waste. So acting as a kind of philosophical detective, he traces the modern crisis back to the earliest stages of thought, when thinking just began. And it began, he claims, in ancient Greece, particularly with the pre-Socratic philosophers, like Parmenides and Heraclitus, who started asking about the nature of the universe. Their basic question can be put a number of different ways. What is being? Or what does being mean? Or why is there something rather than nothing? Similarly, we can imagine ancient Jedi first philosophizing about the nature of the Force, which eventually leads to the discovery and use of its dark side. The pre-Socratics' response to being was pure astonishment, which was appropriate. Indeed, we too should be blown away by the sheer being of being. And, in our astonishment, we should not attempt to divide up reality into scientific parts, but to marvel at being, to marvel that there is a universe at all, through poetry, just as the pre-Socratics did, and just as the Jedi marvel at the Force. This was a noble beginning to thought, but today, according to Heidegger, the question of being doesn't really even come up on the screen anymore, as Heidegger puts it in Being and Time. The question has today been forgotten. Moreover, Heidegger doesn't mean a little memory loss, but a much deeper sense of forgetfulness. We actually forget about our own existence, a kind of ontological amnesia. And if the question of being, or the Force, does happen to arise, we are always quick to dismiss it as a meaningless garble. Consider, for example, the many non-Jedi, like Han Solo and Admiral Mahdi, who simply don't recognize the power of the Force. What the Jedi call the Force, Han refers to as a lot of simple tricks and nonsense. And Mahdi condescendingly mocks Vader's sad devotion to that ancient religion. So why exactly did we forget the question of being? The answer, in a word, is technology, and especially for Heidegger, modern technology. Historically speaking, technology was at its best in the age of the ancient Greeks, who conceived it as an art and as craft. But gradually, technology was corrupted. In order to explain this historical transition, Heidegger distinguishes between two kinds of technological experience, the ready-to-hand and the present-at-hand. The ready-to-hand is our primitive tool-use relation. We experience tools in the external environment as natural extensions of our bodies. In Heidegger's terminology, we are attuned to our world through our basic equipment, We are at home in the world. As we'll see, the Jedi used technology, such as the lightsaber, in just this way. This is authentic existence, our authentic being in the world, being at one with the world. As such, we care for nature in this mode. We care for our homes, for each other, and above all, for the earth, and thereby allow nature to reveal its own internal natural forms on its own terms. We care for being, in general, just as a nerf herder cares for his nerfs. As Heidegger puts it, man is not the lord of beings. Man is the shepherd of being. The present at hand, by contrast, is the opposite. We experience ourselves as lords of beings, who are detached from the environment by way of high-tech tools. Not so much in our various machine products, like AT-AT walkers, X-Wing fighters, and hologram generators, but more in our basic attitude toward the universe. The essence of technology, according to Heidegger, is really a new way of seeing. In the present at hand, we experience nature as a set of detached objects, as though we've put on some new and super powerful goggles that allow us to see far deeper into the hidden layers of nature. And of course, the more we can see, the more we can control. In fact, nowadays we can grind up or reprogram just about anything with hydroelectric dams and deforestation, unlimited surveillance, and nanotechnology. But in doing so, we are in fact challenging nature to reveal itself to us as something for us, something which serves our instrumental needs, and not as being in itself. Rather than caring for being and allowing it to reveal itself on its own terms, we challenge it to reveal itself on our terms. So, in effect, while we're forcing nature to reveal a side to us, simultaneously with regard to being as being, it's covered up, as Heidegger puts it, and it shows itself only in a distorted way, just as the Emperor appears distorted in Return of the Jedi and Revenge of the Sith. Heidegger calls this process of distortion enframing. Here, everything natural, everything good, is pounded into an artificial frame. Everything is looked at with a cold, hard gaze, objectified and detached. All material for the sterile, stare of white-jacketed lab men or gray-suited imperial officers. Each part of nature is sliced clean from the whole and examined under 1,000 microscopes, prodded with lasers and high-tech pitchforks, all to squeeze out maximal efficiency and total control. This is the age of the world picture, as Heidegger puts it. When nature is placed inside a frame for us to objectify, it is a mere representation of our own instrumental will. Think of how the lush planet of Alderaan is enframed within the Death Star's main view screen just prior to its destruction. Once we have set upon this path of enframing, all that will be left of the Earth are masses of standing reserve. This means reality converted by technology into mere stuff, always standing by, always ready to be used up. Forests become lumber, and rivers become hydroelectric power. Nature thus appears only as a set of lifeless objects, always ready for quick use. But a further problem arises. In boxing up the earth, we gradually lose sight of the natural order of things. Out of sight, out of mind. Our new technological vision clouds our old understanding of the world. And slowly but surely, we begin to forget the question of being. In his later years, Heidegger reflected on these phenomena of progressive enframing and increasing forgetfulness, but with an apparent sense of despair. There's nothing we can do to stop the massive machine of enframing. It's completely out of our hands. Perhaps we once could, but it's now impossible. We simply cannot save ourselves. As Heidegger says, only a god can save us. An elegant weapon, the lightsaber, as ready to hand. We find the same Heideggerian saga of technology in Star Wars. Here, the natural ready to hand is corrupted by the present at hand relation and the will to enframe all things. Moreover, in the wake of the path of enframing by the Empire, masses of standing reserve are generated, and as a consequence of this enframing and standing reserve, a certain forgetting occurs, particularly evident invader's own forgetfulness of himself. Ultimately, this forgetting is so deep, the standing reserves so massive, and the path of enframing so aggressive, that in the end, only a god can save us. Or in this case, only the Jedi Knight, Luke Skywalker. Luke's adventure begins on Tatooine. Following his runaway droid R2-D2, Luke encounters Obi-Wan Kenobi, who has in fact been waiting a long time to give Luke something very special.
Your father's lightsaber. This is the weapon of a Jedi Knight. Not as clumsy or random as a blaster. An elegant weapon for a more civilized age.
On board the Millennium Falcon, Luke starts his very Heideggerian training. He must learn to think of his lightsaber not as some external and value-neutral object that's present to him, but as a natural part of his body, an extension of his very being. In other words, he must make the transition from the present at hand to the ready to hand. And more importantly, he must conceive both himself and his lightsaber as dynamic and fluid extensions of the Force itself. Luke practices his swordsmanship with a training remote, a small floating sphere, which hovers around him, stinging him with laser beams. Failing at first to defend himself, Obi-Wan suggests Luke wear a helmet with the blast shield down, so he cannot see at all, which Luke can hardly understand. But Obi-Wan instructs him,
"Your eyes can deceive you. Don't trust them."
Effectively, Luke is warned not to use the present at hand, but to feel the moment.
Remember, a Jedi can feel the Force flowing through him.
Luke re-engages the training remote and immediately succeeds.
"You know, I did feel something," Luke tells Obi-Wan.
He has begun to learn that the Force is not at all a visual experience, but one of feeling. As though an energy field were flowing through him, connecting him to all things. In the words of Yoda, Luke is beginning to
unlearn what he has learned.
And indeed, a lesson that will prove valuable later on when Luke must battle a much greater artificial sphere, the Death Star.
"Use the Force, Luke,"
he hears Obi-Wan's voice speaking through the Force.
"Let go, Luke."
Quickly approaching his final target and remembering his early training with the remote, Luke turns off his computer-controlled targeting system, much to the worry of his team, effectively blinding himself again. Aiming only through the Force, he fires a perfect shot into the Death Star's core, blowing it to pieces. Yoda as being in the Dagobah system. As great as this accomplishment is, however, Luke is not yet a Jedi Knight. He must continue his training under a new Jedi Master, Yoda, who lives in the Dagobah system. Yoda appears as an organic extension of his natural environment, perhaps the best example of Heideggerian attunement in Star Wars. Yoda's being in the world is one entirely based in the ready-to-hand. With no technology to speak of, Yoda has only some basic equipment for cooking and living in his natural environment. And his dwelling is made of earth and mud. As a being in the world, a being connected with his environment, Yoda lives as one with his surroundings, in perfect harmony with nature. Emerald green like the lush marshes all around him, he's similarly filled with the natural light of the Force. He's at home in the world, and nothing on Dagobah is covered over. His existence here is authentic. Indeed, the contrast with the hard lines and right angles of the Galactic Republic is made quite explicit when Luke descends on Dagobah, covered in technology. His X-Wing fighter, his high-tech uniform, his companion R2-D2, and even his food all appear very synthetic. Amused at the absurdity, Yoda asks Luke directly,
"How you get so big eating food of this kind?"
None of this sort of thing is essential to Yoda, and still less is essential for Luke's own Jedi training in the swamp. Although Yoda apparently cannot help himself from stealing Luke's little light pen,
"Mine, or I will help you not!"
Probably because it reminds him of the old days of the Republic and of his own lightsaber, an essential piece of Jedi technology that Yoda no longer wears on his person. Only a few feet tall, long-eared and green, hobbling along on tridactyl feet with the aid of his Geimer stick, Yoda seems harmless, even ridiculous.
And Luke cannot, for the life of him, imagine that this pesky little creature is a great Jedi warrior. Not that wars make one great, as Yoda later notes. From Luke's still-clouded perspective of things, Yoda is simply too small to be a Jedi, just as Luke's X-Wing fighter is simply too large to retrieve from the swamp. Luke is still very young, though, and not yet well-trained in the ways of the Force. Too much of his father in him, as Luke's perceptive Aunt Beru foresees. But before he leaves Dagobah, Luke will learn a great many things, and beginning precisely here, with his own inverted view of the world, Yoda tells Luke,
"Size matters not. Look at me. Judge me by my size, do you? And well, you should not, for my ally is the Force, and a powerful ally it is. Life creates it, makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. You must feel the Force around you. Here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere. Yes, even between the land and the ship."
This description of the Force also closely resembles Heidegger's conception of being. Like the Force, being is everywhere, all around us. It binds all of the elements of the universe together. It's that which undergirds the rocks just as surely as starfighters. Yet, in being everywhere, the Force, or being, is equally nowhere. For being everywhere at once, it isn't easily locatable, which makes it so easy to forget. But we must learn to experience it through the art of the ready-to-hand, and above all, through meditation, as Yoda advises Luke on Dagobah. Similarly, Qui-Gon tells young Anakin that when he learns to quiet his mind and meditate, the Force will speak to him. For Heidegger, too, we must meditate on being in order for it to speak to us. For just as there is a voice of the Force, so too is there a voice of being. As Heidegger puts it, "For strictly, it is language that speaks. Man first speaks when, and only when, he responds to language, by listening to its appeal. And language, according to Heidegger, is speaking as being. Language is the house of being. In its home, man dwells." In Framing and the Eye of the Empire. Powerful as the light side of the Force may be, however, the dark side is also very strong. And those who follow its path are the Dark Lords of the Sith. Rather than emphasizing the importance of a passive and quiet, contemplative mind, the Sith are trained in aggression and technical thinking, control and domination. In a word, they're trained in the mode of the present at hand, rather than the illumined ready to hand. Instead of feeling the Force, the Sith are trained visually to control nature as a set of external objects. All of reality, on this view, is ready to be subordinated and controlled, and all for the sole purpose of increasing their power over nature. Filled with anger, filled with fear, the dark side of the Force, taken to its logical limit, is precisely what gives rise to the darkest phenomenon of reality, in Framing. Perhaps nowhere in Star Wars is this combination of the present at hand and in Framing more evident than in the Death Star. Resembling a small moon, the Death Star is in fact a space station, but on even closer inspection, it actually resembles a massive artificial eyeball, much like the gigantic eye in Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. It has a windowed iris and a distinct pupil, out of which Darth Vader and the Emperor watch, and the entire structure rotates to observe its territory within a massive solar socket of space. Moreover, under this present-at-hand gaze, the Empire steadily builds masses of standing reserve, most evident in the droid army and the clone factory on the ocean planet Kamino. These clones are inframed internally through genetic engineering to decrease their autonomy and increase their collective thought. While later they are inframed externally as they are sheathed in the hard white armor and helmets of the Imperial Stormtroopers. One should note here, however, that the standing reserve is not all on the Empire's side. Both sides use masses of droids and spacecraft, and the Republic, before it becomes the Empire, uses the clone army to fight the Separatists in attack of the clones. On the other hand,
The massive rise of enframing and standing reserve is hardly being directed by Yoda and Mace Windu, or even through the light side of the Force. Rather, the dark side has stealthily gained control of the process of enframing without the Jedi knowing it. As Count Dooku confidently informs Obi-Wan, "The dark side of the Force has clouded their vision, my friend. The void of darkness is slowly but surely spreading and extinguishing the Jedi's power to use the Force. And this applies equally to young Anakin Skywalker, the soon-to-be Darth Vader." With not a little concern about Anakin's fear of losing his mother, Yoda warns,
"Clouded this boy's future is."
This clouding of the Force by the dark side is precisely the covering up of being by enframing. Heidegger says, being can be covered up to such a degree that it is forgotten, and the question about it and its meaning altogether omitted. In Anakin's case, at the very height of his own enframing, this clouding will indeed become forgetting, as Luke rightly points out. The enframing of Anakin Skywalker. Anakin and his mother Shmi are slaves, both owned by Watto, a Toydarian junk dealer. And Anakin knows it's wrong. Even as a little boy, he's well aware that Watto subordinates his personhood, evident in his first meeting with Padme.
"You're a slave?" she asks him.
"I'm a person, and my name is Anakin," he responds. As a slave, Anakin works on all manner of machines and is actually quite gifted in his work. He even brags to Qui-Gon that he can help fix their ship's hyperdrive, and also takes considerable pride in showing Padme his newest creation, a protocol droid for his mother, C-3PO. But despite all his talents, Anakin's powers have already been wrongly honed in the service of control. He lives in a world of high-tech tools, and so many enframed things which themselves require tools. Indeed, at a very basic level, Anakin himself is Watto's own living tool, which is precisely how Aristotle defines a slave in the Politics. These distortions of slavery and the immersion in technology are the initial steps of a descent that will later spiral downward and out of control with the death of Anakin's mother at the hands of the vulgar and nomadic sand people. Infuriated at his powerlessness to keep Shmi alive, as her poor tortured body goes limp in his arms, Anakin, aflame with rage, proceeds to slaughter the entire community of sand people, including the women and children. Trying to console him, Padme clumsily explains that Shmi's death was not his fault.
"You're not all powerful."
But furious, Anakin insists, "Well, I should be. Someday I will be. I will be the most powerful Jedi ever." At this point, Anakin's early technological skills and interests become obsessions for control and manipulation. Perhaps once he wanted to free the slaves, as he told Qui-Gon he had dreamed, and be the shepherd of being, as Heidegger means, shepherd, in the sense not only for caring for, but also setting free. But now he is on the path to becoming the Lord of Beings, in the form of Lord Vader. His rage has permanently unbalanced him, and this is nowhere near more evident than in his futile charging attack on Count Dooku against Obi-Wan's desperate warning. Ultimately, Yoda rescues Anakin and Obi-Wan from the powerful Sith Lord, but Anakin has lost his arm to Dooku's lightsaber. Severed from his natural ready-to-hand relation, his natural being in the world is now robotically mediated through an artificial hand attached to a cyborg arm. As a result of his thoughtless fury, Anakin is now shifted from the ready-to-hand, a natural hand linked to the Force and humanity, to the present-at-hand, the artificial hand link to the dark side. And this is only the beginning. His next step toward becoming fully enframed is brought about by Obi-Wan himself, Anakin's teacher. Following a violent battle of lightsabers between the two, Anakin is left severely maimed, and his biological body is no longer capable of sustaining itself on its own. After an extensive robotic rebuilding of his body, Anakin now wears a full suit of black armor and a helmet with a mask covering his entire face. His senses are all now artificially mediated through technology, while he is fed through an internal tube in his helmet.
virtually everything vital has been replaced. His spine, his internal organs, his entire experience of the world is completely mediated by artifice. Even his voice is translated through a computer, while his breathing is controlled by an internal ventilator. He's more machine now than man, twisted and evil. And this new machine of a man is a terribly imposing figure, to say the least. Only later are we given a rare voyeuristic look into the layers of Vader's enframing. In The Empire Strikes Back, an Imperial officer accidentally witnesses Vader privately dressing. We even see his pale human skin, kept private from the light, and his awful mutilated skull. But only for a second, as a quick robotic arm plunges down his helmet. Freshly closed to the world, Vader now commands the officer, only to turn away as the top of his demonic black nest closes down all around him. Ultimately, the same process of descent into enframing happens to Luke as well, whose hand is severed by Vader and replaced with a robotic hand. And even later, Vader loses his hand again to Luke's lightsaber. But upon cutting off Vader's robotic hand, Luke notices his own robotic hand covered by a black glove similar to Vader's. Luke now understands Yoda's earlier concern. He may yet follow the same path.
A Jedi's strength flows from the Force, but beware of the dark side. Anger, fear, aggression. The dark side of the Force are they. Easily they flow, quick to join you in a fight. If you once start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny. Consume you it will, as it did Obi-Wan's apprentice.
Vader, is the dark side stronger?
No, no, no. Quicker, easier, more seductive.
We hear the same worry from Obi-Wan. Vader was seduced by the dark side of the Force. Indeed, the dark side's powers are incredibly intense, as Vader tries to explain to Luke.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
In the end, however, Luke does not succumb, and his own artificial enframing remains relatively minimal compared to Vader's. Only a Jedi can save us, forgetting and recollecting. Vader's enframing is, to be sure, all but complete. His being in the world is so artificially meditated, so incredibly distorted, that he no longer fully understands what he is doing, or why. No longer human, he has entirely lost touch with himself. It's true that Vader may not have forgotten the question of being in general, as Heidegger conceives it, but clearly, he has forgotten something. He has, at the very least, forgotten the man he used to be. And beyond that, in a very Heideggerian sense, he has equally forgotten his own original being in the world. Indeed, he has even forgotten his own name. Luke makes exactly this point to Vader when he calls him by his original name, Anakin Skywalker. Vader, irritated, scolds Luke.
That name no longer has any meaning for me.
But Luke persists. It is the name of your true self. You've only forgotten. And he has forgotten, precisely because of his detachment from the being of the Force and his horrible descent into the darkness of enframing. And now, at the end of the saga, it would indeed appear, with Vader's almost complete forgetfulness, that only a god can save him. Only there is conspicuous absence of god or gods in the Star Wars galaxy. Although angels apparently reside in deep space and the Ewoks mistake 3PO for a god, nevertheless, Vader is ultimately saved by the semi-divine power of the Force and through the actions of Luke. Inspired by Luke's dedication to him, Vader begins to remember. He returns to himself and becomes Anakin Skywalker once again, now with his own eyes. He vanquishes the Emperor and turns his back on the dark side of the Force. But while his soul is saved, his body machine is badly broken, and he succumbs to death. Although not before asking Luke to take off his horrible mask and uncover his true being from the shroud of artifice. The layers of enframing are at last peeled back to reveal the man. His spirits recharged, Luke has not come this far to watch his father die in the Death Star, only moments from destruction. I've got to save you, he declares. But Anakin knows all too well.
You already have, Luke.
Chapter 10. If Droids Could Think, Droids as Slaves and Persons. Robert Arp. Years ago, I watched A New Hope with a blind person named Mary. She asked if I could describe to her what was going on throughout the movie. After the 20th Century Fox fanfare ended and the wonderful John Williams soundtrack began, I read the opening paragraphs to her. What happened after the next few scenes was fascinating. She listened to C-3PO's opening dialogue where he says, somewhat frantically,
"Did you hear that? They shut down the main reactor. We'll be destroyed for sure. This is madness. We're doomed."
However, before I could describe the scene to her, Mary asked me, "What does that man look like?" I told her it was not a man, but a droid, a gold-plated robot who looks like a man. She paused a moment and continued, "Oh, it sounded just like a man." Being naturally inquisitive, I asked Mary what made her think that C-3PO was a man. Her response was that C-3PO used language and had expressed the emotions of fear and concern. My exchange with Mary was fascinating for two reasons. First, if I were blind and a robot approached me on the street and started talking to me the way C-3PO does, with all of his overdramatizing of events, expressions of reluctance, and name-calling, most likely I would think a human being was talking to me. Second, my exchange with Mary made me rethink 3PO's role as a protocol droid built to serve other human beings in a slavish capacity. If C-3PO looks and acts like a person, if he uses language, has certain advanced cognitive skills, is aware of his surroundings, and can feel emotions and express concerns, then what really separates him from actually being a person, other than his silicone and metallic innards and appearance? Furthermore, if he could qualify as a person, then shouldn't such a robot be granted the same kinds of rights and privileges as any other human being who qualifies as a person? If droids meet the conditions for personhood, I question whether they should be granted at least limited rights and privileges, including the ability to choose to work in the Star Wars galaxy, as opposed to being slavishly made to suffer, it's our lot in life, to use 3PO's words, at the hands of biological persons. He's quite clever, you know, for a human being. The first thing we need to do is get at the fundamental nature or essence of what it means to be a person. So what is the definition of a person? A person is a being who has the capacity for 1. Reason or rationality, 2. Mental states like beliefs, intentions, desires, and emotions, 3. Language, 4. Entering into social relationships with other persons, and 5. Being considered a responsible moral agent. Before asking whether droids meet these criteria, and if so, which droids, we should consider the matter of whether a body is absolutely necessary in order to be considered a person. Among the criteria for personhood just given, there is no mention of a physical body. Important implications can be drawn from this omission. First, what it means to be a person is not tied to having an intact bodily experience. Take someone like the famous physicist Stephen Hawking. Here is a man whose body is ravaged by disease, is confined to a wheelchair, and needs machines in order to communicate. Yet we would still consider him a person because, despite his bodily limitations, he fulfills criteria 1 through 5. He does this because his brain is still functioning properly and his cognitive capacities remain intact. He reasons, feels, communicates, albeit with the help of machines, and has been able to form strong social bonds in the scientific community, as well as in his personal life. So on the face of it, it appears that cognitive capacities are what to look for when trying to discern whether a being qualifies as a person. And the brain, or something that functions like the brain, is the seat of this cognitive capacity. If bodily existence is downplayed, and cognitive capacities are what really count when defining a person, then droids like C-3PO and R2-D2 could be considered persons, provided their cognitive capacities are the same as other persons. We naturally think that persons will be biological entities with brains who breathe air, metabolize carbohydrates, and take in water for nourishment. Right now, however, it's possible to simulate various biological parts of bodies artificially. There are artificial hearts, artificial kidneys, and even artificial eyes. Suppose that a scientist develops an artificial occipital lobe, the back part of the brain, out of silicone and metal, and implants it into a brain of an adult female human being. The artificial lobe performs the same functions that a natural occipital lobe performs. It processes visual information from the environment. So with her artificial lobe, she can do the same thing that she could do with her natural lobe. She can see the world around her. Say that the scientist develops artificial silicone and metallic parts of the brain responsible for memory and implants those into our subject's brain. She can now store and recall memories with the artificial parts of the brain in the same way she could with her natural parts. Now say the scientist develops an artificial silicone and metal brain in its entirety and implants it into our subject. With this artificial brain, she can do all of the same things she did before her transplant. She lives, loves, lies, and meets all of the criteria for personhood. Would she actually be a person, however, given that her brain is robotic? Say the scientist can simulate all parts of her body with silicone and metal, and thus replaces her biological body with a robotic body. She now is fully a robotic being with all of the same hopes, fears, responsibilities, loyalties, and so on, as any other human being. Would she, or should we say if, actually be a person? It seems possible to simulate the mental capacities necessary for personhood through physical things other than the brain. Why would one need to have a brain in order to think, believe, feel, experience, and the like, if such cognitive capacities can be simulated by other means? Think of an android like Data in Star Trek The Next Generation, or the replicants in the movie Blade Runner, or the synthetics like Bishop, as Bishop says they prefer to be called, in the Alien movies. These are examples of beings that act like persons, yet the internal workings of their brains consist of a series of silicone and metallic connections, or other artificial systems, that are very different from the gray matter of the brain. So it seems that a functioning brain, or something that functions like a brain, with all of the cognitive capacities associated with such functioning, is the most important thing to consider when determining whether something qualifies as a person. If droids could think, there'd be none of us here, would there? Now we can address the question as to whether droids qualify as persons. The first qualification has to do with the capacity for reason or rationality. In one sense, reasoning is the same thing as intelligence. It involves a variety of capacities, including A, calculating, B, making associations between present stimuli and stored memories, C, problem solving, and D, drawing new conclusions or inferences from old information. Do droids qualify as rational or intelligent in these senses? Droids obviously make calculations. In The Empire Strikes Back, C-3PO lets Han Solo know that the odds of successfully navigating an asteroid field are approximately
3,720-1 against.
Also, in The Phantom Menace, droidicas judge distance while rolling up to and firing their lasers at Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan aboard the Trade Federation ship. Droids also have memory storage capabilities and can recall memories based upon present stimuli. When Jabba's droid manager, EV-99, notes that R2-D2 will make a fine addition to Jabba's sail barge crew, he can do so only because he has a memory of the barge, the crew, the work detail, as well as a capacity to associate R2's actions with the barge, crew, and work detail. C-3PO knows 6 million forms of communication, has been on many adventures with R2, and is able to recount his past experiences to Luke. He even recounts the story of his previous Star Wars films to the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi. Furthermore, droids can solve problems. In Return of the Jedi, R2 takes the initiative to open the doors to the command center on Endor while he, Leia, and Han are under attack by stormtroopers. R2 performs similar mechanical problem-solving when he gets the Millennium Falcon's hyperdrive to work in The Empire Strikes Back, and the Naboo Royal Starship shields up to escape the Trade Federation blockade in The Phantom Menace. Finally,
droids seem to be able to reason by deductively drawing conclusions and making inferences. Think of the holographic chess game played between R2 and Chewbacca on board the Millennium Falcon in A New Hope, and Han's comment that droids don't pull people's arms out of their sockets when they lose. Wookiees are known to do that. C-3PO comes to the conclusion that R2 should choose a new strategy. Let the Wookiee win. This conclusion is arrived at by a process of reasoning that goes something like this. 1. Premise 1. If R2 wins, my arms will be pulled out of their sockets. 2. Premise 2. I don't want my arms pulled out of their sockets. 3. Conclusion. Thus, R2 should let the Wookiee win. R2 also displays some clever deductive reasoning in his first conversation with Luke. He deceives Luke into removing his restraining bolt by falsely claiming that its removal will enable the image of Princess Leia to return, knowing how much Luke would want to see the entire message. The little manipulator appears to have reasoned his actions through quite well. I am fluent in over 6 million forms of communication. Just because something can reason does not mean that it is a person. A computer can be trained to reason in the same way that C-3PO does with Chewbacca, or R2 does with Luke, making step-by-step calculations. Yet, we would not consider a computer a person because of this capacity alone. Persons have the capacity for mental states and language. Mental states are a part of a human being's psychological life, and include such things as holding a belief, having a desire, feeling a pain, or experiencing some event. Probably the best way to understand what a mental state consists of is to close your eyes and think about experiences where you felt some pain, jumped for joy, or regretted a decision you made. First, think about the pain you experienced. Maybe it had to do with touching something that was very hot. Recall how that pain was all-consuming for its duration, how it lingered in your body, and how you thought, "Ow, that hurt." And maybe express some other choice intergalactic expletives. That was your pain, and no one else's, and only you could know what that pain was like. Only Han knows what his pain is like when the hydro spanners fall on his head and the Empire Strikes Back. All we can know is that he experienced pain based on his vocal expression. Ow! Chewie! Now, recall a time when you felt joy and elation over some accomplishment of your own, or of someone else's. Like winning an award, or your favorite team scoring the winning goal in the last seconds of the game. Recall the experience, how you smiled, relished the moment, and wished that every moment could be like this one. Only Luke and Han know the joy of receiving a medal for heroism from the beautiful Princess Leia at the end of A New Hope. Poor Chewie doesn't get to have that experience himself. Finally, think of a decision you made that you have come to regret. You believe now that you could have made a different, better decision back then, and now, having thought about it, it may cause you pain. Surely, many regrets pass through the dying Anakin Skywalker's mind after his redemption at the end of Return of the Jedi. These three experiences seem to get at the idea of a mental state because they entail beliefs, emotions, desires, and intentions. It would seem that only members of the human race experience such mental states. We don't have any evidence of other animals realizing that their pain is their pain, relishing moments, thinking back to past events with regret, or looking forward to future events with joy and anticipation. The capacity for language is another qualification for being considered a person. Language is a tricky thing to understand, and many people think that each kind of animal has its own language, including bees, ants, apes, dolphins, and even tauntauns, just to name a few. We must distinguish, though, between communicating some information and speaking a language. Whereas communicating some information does not require having mental states, speaking a language does entail mental states. When speaking a language, it seems that more than mere information is communicated. Beliefs, desires, intentions, hopes, dreams, fears, and the like are relayed from one person to another. Many beings can communicate information by relaying some useful data back and forth to one another. All animals do this to some extent. A bee is not speaking to another bee when doing his little bee dance in order to communicate information about where pollen is located outside of the hive. I know this is going to sound controversial, but even apes who have been taught sign language are not speaking, using a language, to their trainers. They merely are associating stimuli with stored memories. As far as we know, no bees or apes have experiences of joy, hope, or anticipation to communicate. Do droids have capacities for mental states and language? There are plenty of examples of droids apparently engaged in behaviors expressive of mental states and language. One glaring example is the torturing of a droid at Jabba the Hutt's palace in Return of the Jedi. When the droid's feet are burned, the little guy appears to know what's going on, anticipates the pain he's going to experience, and screams in pain and terror when the hot iron is lowered. Interestingly enough, one also gets the sense that the droid administering the torture is enjoying what he's doing. C-3PO expresses emotions himself on numerous occasions. Before getting into an escape pod with R2, he claims, "I'm going to regret this." On Tatooine, he despairs, "How did we get into this mess? We seem to be made to suffer. It's our lot in life." After reuniting with R2 and the Jawa Sandcrawler, 3PO exclaims, "R2-D2, it is you! It is you!" When Luke comes back to discover R2 has gone off to look for Obi-Wan Kenobi, he finds 3PO hiding, expressive of shame, and begging not to be deactivated, expressive of fear. When Luke returns to Yavin 4 after destroying the Death Star, and 3PO realizes that R2 has been damaged, he offers his own body parts in order to save his little friend. In The Empire Strikes Back, C-3PO expresses sorrow and reverence when Luke cannot be located before the main doors of the Hoth outpost are shut for the night, because Luke likely will freeze to death. Frustration at having Han's hand placed over his mouth in order to shut him up, as well as fear before being shot by stormtroopers on Cloud City. C-3PO exhibits many more examples of anticipation, fear, anger, joy, as well as put-downs. "You nearsighted scrap pile," and "overweight glob of grease," directed toward R2, and passive aggression. "Fine, go that way," again directed toward R2. 3PO and R2 share a very human-like, personable relationship, wrought with the same kinds of normal as well as abnormal communication that any person may have in relationships. This is probably why we find them so appealing as characters, sometimes more so than the human characters in the films. Think of the brief exchange between 3PO and R2 in A New Hope after Luke leaves for dinner with his aunt and uncle. R2 asks C-3PO if Luke likes him, and C-3PO responds, "No, I don't think he likes you at all." Plaintive whistle from R2. "No, I don't like you either." It's an adorable scene to the viewer precisely because the communication is tongue-in-cheek and somewhat dysfunctional. It would seem that this kind of communication takes place only between beings having true mental states. Besides having and expressing emotions, droids also seem to have beliefs about themselves, others, and the world around them. And they act on those beliefs, whether it is to save themselves, aid others, or engage in other kinds of actions. Put another way, they appear to be free in their actions precisely because they form beliefs and can act on those beliefs. In A New Hope, while stormtroopers are searching Mos Eisley, C-3PO holds the belief that if R2 locks the door to the room in which they are hiding, then the stormtroopers will check the door, note that it is locked, and move on. Sure enough, that's exactly what happens, and 3PO's belief is ratified. When R2 is roaming by himself on Tatooine, near caves where Jawas are hiding, he holds the belief that danger is near, adjusts his direction, and rotates his head back and forth to keep an eye out for the suspected danger. He engages in these actions precisely because he holds the belief that danger is near. Finally, droids have the capacity for language. When R2 beeps a series of electronic sounds into Luke's computer on board his X-Wing fighter, or to 3PO for translation, this isn't merely an expression of data communication. Language is dependent upon, and expressive of, true mental states. It would appear that droids have mental states, And so when they communicate, it would appear that what's being communicated constitutes linguistic expression, and not simply data transference. Droids want other droids and other beings to understand what they are communicating. I want you to understand what I'm experiencing, feeling, thinking, and the like, when I speak to you. So too, when 3PO tries to reassure Luke that R2 is a reliable droid, while the two are being sold by the Jawas. He wants Luke to understand where he's coming from in terms of his beliefs about R2 being a real bargain. You've been a great pal. I'll make sure Mom doesn't sell you. Do droids have the capacity to enter into social relationships with other persons? Social relationships can be divided into A, family relationships, such as Luke's relationship with his Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. B, economic relationships, such as Han Solo or Boba Fett's relationship with Jabba the Hutt. C, allegiance relationships, such as those among the multi-species members of the Rebel Alliance. And D, civil relationships, such as the relationship among the citizens of Naboo and between them and their elected queen. In each one of these relationships, one finds duties, rights, laws, and obligations that would be appropriate to each relationship. For example, in a family, a parent has a duty to take care of a child, and one of the fundamental laws in such a relationship is unconditional love. In economic transactions, the fundamental obligation is to the bottom line of staying in the black, and the laws may include something like, let the buyer beware, or don't drop your spice shipment at the first sign of an Imperial cruiser. In civil relationships, rights and laws are utilized in the most commonly understood way so as to protect citizens from harm and ensure the prospering of societies as a whole. On the face of it, it would seem that droids don't have the capacity to enter into any one of these relationships. After all, they don't have families. They seem to be barred from economic transactions.
We don't serve their kind here,
declares the bartender at the Mos Eisley Cantina. They aren't a part of any droid interest groups, and they definitely aren't citizens who bear any rights in either the Republic or the Rebel Alliance. However, two scenes in The Empire Strikes Back make it possible to believe that a kind of familial relationship can be fostered between a droid and a non-droid. First, we note the care and concern Chewie takes when he tries to put C-3PO back together in the cell on Cloud City, and later when he straps C-3PO to his back so as not to abandon him when he and Leia try to free Han and flee from Vader. There is also Luke's reaction to R2's falling into the swamp after they land on Dagobah. Luke expresses shock, concern, and is even willing to fight to save R2 from being eaten by whatever monster sucked him up, and subsequently spit him out. The care expressed in both of these cases is analogous to the care a father might have for his son, or an older brother might have for a younger brother. These characters form a kind of family. Droids also seem to care for their masters, as in The Empire Strikes Back, when R2 sits at the foot of the door probing for Luke, who is lost out in the cold on Hoth. Or in Attack of the Clones, when C-3PO's head realizes, to his shock, that his battle droid body is shooting at friendly Jedi in the arena on Geonosis.
I'm terribly sorry about all this.
This indicates, at the very least, a rudimentary reciprocal social relationship. Yet, droids are exploited. They are treated as little more than pieces of machinery, slaves whose purpose is to serve non-droids. 3PO and R2 are hunted down, fitted with restraining bolts, and sold by Jawas into slavery. And 3PO refers to his previous master when giving his work history to Luke in their initial conversation. Droids lack the rights and responsibilities afforded to other beings, such as humans and Wookiees, as well as fish-headed and hammer-headed creatures in the Star Wars galaxy. Given what we know about droids, such as R2 and 3PO, it is unfortunate they are treated as slaves. Droids communicate, have the capacity for reason, and can be involved in complex social relationships. More importantly, they express feelings of disillusion, contempt, pain, and suffering, as well as joy, satisfaction, and contentment. A being that has these traits appears to have mental states. And such a being is arguably a person, regardless of having been created by persons. Maybe it's time for droid liberation in the Star Wars galaxy, in much the same way that the other groups of people who have been unjustly enslaved throughout human history have been liberated. Of course, if droids were liberated, then they would need to establish their own social relationships, ways to propagate, moral laws, and the like for themselves. At the same time, there would need to be adjustments made in the existing social spheres of the Star Wars galaxy to accommodate droid needs and wants, and to mainstream them into existing social spheres, in much the same way Wookiees, Gungans, and other creatures have been incorporated. It's not our lot in life. I have a proposal to make. Droids appear to meet the qualifications.